This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote. U.S. President Joe Biden granted temporary refuge Thursday to people from Hong Kong amid the Chinese government's effort to crush the pro-democracy movement and tighten its control on the city. Biden signed a memorandum allowing people from Hong Kong currently residing here in the U.S. to live and work in the country for 18 months, a move likely to further inflame the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing. The decision to provide a temporary safe haven comes in response to Hong Kong's sweeping new national security law, which took effect in June. Since then, police have arrested at least 100 opposition politicians, activists, and demonstrators. Changes have also been made to Hong Kong's election laws to reduce the number of directly elected lawmakers and give a largely pro-Beijing committee the leeway to nominate lawmakers aligned with the mainland government. Two Belarusian coaches have been stripped of their Tokyo Olympics accreditations over an alleged attempt to force a sprinter to fly home, an incident that drew international condemnation. The International Olympic Committee on Friday said it had removed the accreditations of the coaches and they had left the Olympic Village. The body said this week that it was investigating the pair over their role in the case of Kristina Tymanovskaya, who sought protection at a Tokyo airport to avoid being put on a plane home. She said she feared for life if forced back to Belarus, which has been racked by political upheaval and a crackdown on dissent after disputed elections that returned strongman Alexander Lukashenko to power last year. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. By remote, this is VOA News. Pakistan is echoing warnings from Washington that neither the Afghan government nor the Taliban can get what they want if they insist on pushing ahead with military campaigns instead of working to reach an agreement through negotiations. Fighting between government forces and Taliban fighters has surged in recent weeks, with the August 31st deadline for the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan drawing even closer, prompting U.S. officials, or forces that is, to increase the number of airstrikes in support of the Afghan military. Yet Pakistan's National Security Advisor in Washington for meetings with U.S. officials said Thursday that a military victory for the Afghan government or the Taliban is simply not realistic. Mohit Yousaf told a virtual audience at the U.S. Institute for Peace, in his words, a compromise is inevitable. U.S. officials have insisted repeatedly that a Taliban victory is not a foregone conclusion. Firefighters are battling several blazes in Greece, including a resurgent fire which burned homes north of Athens. In southern Greece, fires prompted more evacuations as weather conditions worsened and firefighters fought to save a former royal palace and the birthplace of the ancient Olympics. The Greece military and personnel from European countries are now assisting firefighters trying to control and put out the blazes. Here in the U.S., California's largest wildfire destroyed much of the downtown and some surrounding homes in a small Northern California mountain community. The three-week-old Dixie Fire tore through Greenville, leveling businesses and homes Wednesday night. Firefighters had been trying to protect the town of 800, clearing debris and roads and marking hazards. So far, more than 20,000 firefighters and support personnel are battling 97 active wildfires covering 13 states here in the U.S., according to the National Interagency Fire Center. And the White House is considering requiring foreign visitors to show proof of vaccination to potentially restart international travel. The White House COVID-19 response coordinator said Thursday that multiple federal agencies are looking into the possibility. The United States still has no timetable for resuming international travel, given the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. The U.S. first imposed travel restrictions on China in January of 2020. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote. VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, August the 6th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, on a visit to Ethiopia this week, said that she had raised her concerns about dehumanizing rhetoric and called on all sides to start a dialogue to end the conflict.
There is no military solution to an internal conflict.
USAID head Samantha Power at a press briefing in Addis Ababa. And the World Bank UN Refugee Agency survey in 8 developing countries finds the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened conditions for forcibly displaced people.
In Kenya, for example, adults in half of refugee households are skipping meals so that their children have food to eat. And more than 75% of refugee households decrease the number of meals that they eat every day.
Jeffrey Tanner is a senior economist of the World Bank UNHCR Joint Data Center on forced displacement. And in Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Front, PF, says incumbent President Edgar Lungu deserves another term because he kept his promises to Zambians. VOA's Peter Claudie is in Lusaka and will bring us this report. We also have sports with Samson O'Malley from Abuja. So stay tuned. Head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, said that during her visit to Ethiopia this week, she had raised her concerns about dehumanizing rhetoric with authorities amid war in the country's northern region. Mrs. Power spoke at a briefing in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, after meeting regional leaders. Her visit comes at a critical moment in the 9-month conflict that has affected millions in the Horn of Africa. Samantha Power called for a cessation of hostilities and a start of a dialogue to resolve the conflict.
There is no military solution to an internal conflict. Values like all parties should end hostilities and agree to an immediate ceasefire and to begin talks about reconciliation and troop and militia withdrawal from neighboring regions.
Ms. Power's visit to Ethiopia and to neighboring Sudan follows calls from the Biden's administration for the Ethiopian government to facilitate the movement of humanitarian aid to the Tigray region to avert what she called an alarming humanitarian catastrophe. She said that the U.S. was only interested in the peaceful end to the conflict.
Whether the United States is lobbying one government to release political prisoners or another government to allow greater access to humanitarian aid workers, I want the Ethiopian people to know that we seek to engage with you and with your government on the basis of a set of values, not to play favorites or to pick sides during a conflict.
Answering a question from the media, Ms. Powers emphasized the need to tone down what she termed as dehumanizing rhetoric and a stop to attacks targeting aid workers.
Concern about inflamed rhetoric, dehumanizing rhetoric that you refer to, but also increasingly virulent speech that you find on the internet and in various publications directed at aid workers. And already we have seen horrific attacks against aid workers who are doing nothing more than trying to provide food and other forms of assistance to people in desperate need. So dehumanizing rhetoric of the kind that you refer to only hardens tensions and it historically certainly often accompanies ethnically motivated atrocities.
The USAID chief announced a new set of U.S. aid to help the Ethiopian government in its fight against COVID-19.
I am proud to announce new investments to support the health and humanitarian needs of the Ethiopian people. On top of the more than $149 million in humanitarian assistance to help people affected by the ongoing conflict in Tigray, which I announced last week, Today, I'm announcing more than $45 million in funding to expand and intensify the fight against COVID-19, to support health systems, respond to urgent humanitarian needs, and support vaccinations. This is part of $720 million in new funding that the United States, USAID, is providing to fight the pandemic abroad, including $445 million for sub-Saharan Africa to support COVID-19 response and vaccine readiness and urgent humanitarian needs consistent with the African Union's continental COVID response strategy.
This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. A World Bank UN Refugee Agency survey in 8 developing countries finds the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened conditions for forcibly displaced people, pushing them to take extreme measures to survive. The data was collected from 90,000 phone interviews in Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, Uganda, and Yemen. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An analysis of the data shows forcibly displaced people and the communities hosting them are suffering from the social and economic fallout of the pandemic. However, it finds displaced people are at particular risk from the pandemic, which has increased their vulnerabilities in significant life-threatening ways. The survey highlights the devastating and wide-reaching impacts on the forcibly displaced from government lockdowns. It says they are faced with increased food prices, loss of jobs and income, lack of health care, school closures, and limited freedom of movement. Jeffrey Tanner is senior economist of the World Bank UNHCR Joint Data Center on Forced Displacement. He says families who have been forced to flee their homes due to violence and persecution are at renewed risk of losing their livelihoods.
For example, we see that 9 in 10 refugees in Uganda and 3 in 4 refugees in Chad reported that their total income had decreased since the pandemic. These households have two sources of income, what they earn and what they receive through assistance. They experienced employment losses at rates at least as large, if not larger, than hosts.
This loss of income, he says, means displaced people have difficulty paying for food, housing, medical care, and education for their children. Tanner says food insecurity is a huge problem in all countries surveyed.
Forcibly displaced households across Bangladesh, Chad, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kenya, and Uganda reported reducing their food or non-food consumption, or both. In Kenya, for example, adults in half of refugee households are skipping meals so that their children have food to eat. And more than 75% of refugee households decrease the number of meals that they eat every day.
Authors of the survey note forcibly displaced people rarely are represented in national statistics. They say the continued collection of such data will allow humanitarian and development agencies to target their support to vulnerable groups in ways it will do the most good. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Zambia, the ruling Patriotic Front, PF, says that the incumbent president, Edgar Lungu, has provided leadership, kept his promises to Zambians, and deserves another 5-year term. It says that the incumbent president's key campaign pledge to citizens in his commitment to the continuation of his good works, the country's unity and prosperity. Representatives of the party said the president has pledged to implement policies to jumpstart the economy and improve the living conditions of the people who he says have been impacted by the global coronavirus pandemic. This despite criticism that he failed to resolve the myriad of challenges that face the country. Antonio Mwanza is a media director of the Zambian ruling PF. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that President Lungu's election prospects are looking good.
What are the prospects of the president winning re-election, really, if I may ask you?
Well, this election for President Edgar Chagwa Lungu is simply a formality to fulfill the constitutional requirements to have those elections every 5 years. The president doesn't have real competition. The president who scooped these elections by more than 50% plus one threshold as required by the Constitution. Why do I say so? It's because the Patriotic Front's leadership in the last 10 years cannot be equaled to the previous governments that have been there. Mm. So in terms of economic development, starting with infrastructure development, mm-hmm. road networks, telecommunication, housing, hospitals, schools, universities, this government has performed tremendously beyond the expectations of many Zambians. So our record in the last 10 years has been very clear in terms of transformative economic development.
Hmm. Antonio, what is the president's key campaign message?
So the campaign message of the president has been broken into two parts. First of all, the president has continued to point at what his administration and the Patriotic Front government has done in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. The tremendous economic and social transformative agenda that we have achieved as a party in the last 10 years. Secondly, the second part of the president's message has been the economic recovery plan in the wake of the COVID-19. Mm-hmm. The president is aware that most of the Zambian people have been affected very negatively as a result of the COVID-19. The president is aware of the economic challenges a lot of Zambians are going through in terms of the cost of living and the high prices of essential goods and services. Mm-hmm. And the president is pointing out the people of Zambia to his economic recovery plan to make sure that Zambia is able to have a sustainable and resilient economy, and also make sure that Zambia become an industrialized nation to reduce on the dependence on imports, which have got a direct effect on the price of commodities and prices of services.
The opposition groups are saying that the president has failed to transform the lives of the people, and that the economy is facing a lot of headwinds caused by his lack of leadership, his failure to resolve the economic challenges facing the country. They talk about public debt that aren't being serviced properly, and that he should not get a second term. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Well, sometimes the opposition don't want to be realistic. In the first place, Zambia, before 2011, before the Patriotic Front came into office, was a village. We had a failing public housing system, failing economic system, failing school system, health system. Everything was broken down. What we did, first of all, was to borrow in order to build. So we borrowed to build the road infrastructure network that we need to put up industries, to put up factories. We borrowed to put up the communication infrastructure, and today Zambians across the country are able to communicate and transact via phones and via the internet. We borrowed in order to build schools, to build hospitals, to build universities. We borrowed for production and not for consumption.
Accepting the results of an election is a key part of the election process. The opposition parties have said that the ECZ, or the Electoral Commission of Zambia, appeared to be favoring the Patriotic Front. Will the Patriotic Front accept the outcome of this year's election, irrespective of who wins?
First of all, Patriotic Front is a very democratic party. It's not the first time that we are participating in elections. We have participated in elections since 2001, and we have always accepted the will of the people. The will of the Zambians is what matters, and whatever the outcome, the Patriotic Front is committed to uphold that. If we don't agree with the outcome, there are enough avenues that have been put in the constitution. Mm-hmm. You can go to court and petition and produce evidence of rigging. And if the court believes that the election was stolen from you, the constitution provides for mechanisms to redress or address any grievances that anyone can have. But I want to end by saying this. First of all, we know that the opposition are using two strategies to delegitimize the outcome of this election. So what they're doing two things. They're using violence to intimidate our people so that our people do not turn out. They're banking on voter apathy as a strategy. Number two, they're using violence in order to have a premise that they can use to say these elections were not free and fair, they were violent. So it is a strategy to attack the institutions of government, the institutions that run and manage the elections, so that they can use this as a premise to justify their outcry of rigging. There is no rigging.
That was Antonio Mwanza, the media director for the Zambian ruling PF. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty, currently in Lusaka, where he's covering the upcoming elections. As crime rates in Kenya shot up during the coronavirus pandemic, A Kenyan developer who was a crime victim himself created a mobile application to help people alert police about emergencies. The application has been so successful that Kenya's police has adopted it. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Are you aware that you're under 24-hour surveillance courtesy of the National Police Service?
At Kenya's National Police Command and Control Center, officers are monitoring the movement of the public. While the technology helps in catching suspected criminals, the increase of crime during the pandemic is overwhelming this technology.
So someone can either open the app and trigger on any of those buttons.
But a mobile application created by a Kenyan developer, Vincent Awino, is helping to meet this challenge. Called Upesi, meaning quick in Swahili, Awino's mobile app enables crime victims to raise alerts to police or security firms.
It's on your phone, meaning it's mobile. The response comes to you anywhere you are. It's not fixed. And the coverage is huge because we have a large network of providers. So all the user needs to do is to go on the phone and trigger an alert, or click the phone's power button at least 4 times in order to get emergency.
Kenyan authorities say some members of the public don't report suspected criminals fearing retaliation, but technology such as this can help apprehend criminals. Charles Koskei is the deputy police spokesperson of Kenya's police service.
We endeavor to use technology to fight crime, and any application that can assist in reporting or tracking criminals will be implemented. Technology is key in fighting crime. That's why we are able to track some of the criminals.
Anthony Murithi, who lives with disabilities, is among the millions of Kenyans who could be targeted by criminals as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to disrupt livelihoods.
As a person with a disability, my security is to a large extent compromised because I cannot put up a fight. So I needed something that is going to give me, to be there for me in case of any danger.
In a 2021 report, the United Nations Congress on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice found that the pandemic is putting a strain on authorities' capacity to detect, prevent, and combat crime. Kenya security officials hope that technology will make a difference in crime prevention. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
If you're a teacher in Uganda, you're going to need a COVID vaccine before the next semester starts. The Uganda government says that the COVID vaccine is mandatory for all teachers before opening of schools. Chris Bariomunsi, the government spokesperson, says vaccination is paramount to protect both teachers and learners. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Schools in Uganda were suspended in March 2020, even before the first case of COVID-19 was announced in the country. The government said the move was aimed at protecting at least 15 million students in primary schools, secondary and higher institutions of learning. And recently they were closed again when the government announced a new lockdown as a measure to prevent further spread of the second wave of COVID-19 in the country. Dr. Chris Bariomunsi, the government spokesman, says the government will start vaccinating teachers and students studying medical professions effective this month. Bariomunsi says unfortunately many teachers have continued to shun the vaccination exercise.
We shall not allow teachers to enter class if they haven't been vaccinated, because they will be a danger to themselves, but also a danger to the children. So we would want to urge the public, the teachers inclusive, that once the opportunity comes, accept to take this vaccination.
Slightly more than a million people have received one jab of AstraZeneca vaccine in Uganda. Bariomunsi says the government has procured some millions of doses of vaccines, not only for teachers, but also for children aged 12 and above. Primary school teacher Brian Ochungi says he will take the jab once opportunity avails.
It's okay to vaccinate people because thereby we are curbing the disease among us Ugandans. It will put us on the right track with the government and also the children that are taught.
Nyakusinga Ambrose, who has been teaching students in both upper primary school and high school for over 20 years, says he too will be glad to be inoculated. He says he worries for children who have been out of school for close to 2 years.
With these breaks of lockdown, even when learners go back home, by the time they are allowed to come back, they come almost to begin from zero. They have forgotten much of what they have learned, and their mind is not really in the school setting. You know, life at home in the community is a bit different from school.
Minister Badiomun says the government is well aware of the problem.
Our school system has been inconvenienced, but we would want to open when we are doubly sure that our children are safe, our teachers are safe, and that when we open, then learning can continue without any real disruption.
He says so far the government has procured 688,000 doses of AstraZeneca from the COVAX facility, 647,000 of Pfizer to arrive in September, 299,000 doses of AstraZeneca UK, and 2 million doses of Johnson & Johnson. Ultimately, the government plans to vaccinate at least 21 million Ugandans. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Let's go to Abuja with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the wrap of African highlights from the Tokyo Olympic Games with Burkina Faso's Hughes Fabrice Zango, who made history on Thursday as he claimed his country's first ever Olympic medal in the men's triple jump. The 28-year-old, who also won bronze at the 2019 World Championships, jumped 17.47 meters to claim third spot on the podium. And now to the relays, where Ghana's men's 4x100 meters relay team booked their spot in the finals of the men's 4x100 meters relays with a blistering run in their heat that secured the quartet a new national record in the event. The quartet of Sean Safo Atwi, Benjamin Asmati, Emmanuel Yeboa, and Joseph Paul Amua finished fifth in the very fast heat with a time of 38.08 seconds. But despite their fifth place finish, their time was fast enough to secure them a place in Friday's final. In handball, Egypt's male handball team will be competing with Spain to lay claim to the bronze medal at the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games on Saturday after the two teams failed to reach the finals. The Pharaohs lost 23-27 to France in the semifinals of the Tokyo Games on Thursday, while Spain suffered a 23-27 loss to Denmark. Also on Thursday, Kenya's Abel Kipsang broke the Olympic men's 1,500 meters record in the semifinals to ease into the final in a blistering 3 minutes 31.65 seconds, shattering the mark of 3 minutes 32.07 seconds set by his compatriot Noah Ngeni in 2000, finishing ahead of Norwegian Jakob Ingebrigtsen, who arrived in Tokyo as third fastest this year. And now to day 14 of the Tokyo Olympic Games, where the men's 4x400 meters relay will kick off things in the early evenings at the Olympic Stadium with the heats that includes South Africa in heat number 2, with the final scheduled as the final event of the night. The Olympic Stadium will also host 6 other medal events, including the women's javelin throw that will be followed by the men's 5,000 meters race that will see Joshua Cheptegei of Uganda taken to the starting line. Cheptegei will be alongside 4 of his continental brothers in Nicholas Kipkori, Kimeli of Kenya, and Milkisa Mengisha of Ethiopia, as well as 2 of his own countrymen in Oscar Chilemo and Jacob Kiplomo. The women's 400 meters final will see no African representation, but all eyes will be in the women's 1,500 meters clash for gold, where African hopes will be sky high with 3 champions in Kenyan Faith Kipyegon, Feriwe Gebrezihibiha of Ethiopia, and Uganda's Winnie Nyayonondo, all taken to the starting lineup. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Friday, August the 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend, Africa.